There are a lot of surprises in life, aren't there? We live in a time when the world has drawn close to us, and literally we can be affected by the surprises that are going on around the world in different places much more quickly and readily than we ever could before. Some of our surprises in life, of course, are very personal. I have alluded to you before that Barbara and I find it one of the great, wonderful surprises of our lives that we live in Dallas, Texas. Some time ago, we had some friends who, in another city, who had a very personal and a very unexpected surprise. They were expecting a baby, and that was no surprise. They knew that was coming, and they were quite excited about that. And in fact, everything went along according to schedule and on schedule. She went into labor and went into the hospital and delivered a wonderful, healthy baby boy. No real surprises yet. The doctor, having delivered the baby, was about ready to leave the delivery room. And the nurse said, Doctor, excuse me, I don't think you want to leave yet. And he turned around, and everyone was surprised because that day they had twin boys. Imagine getting that far along and then discovering that there were two instead of one. No time to buy that extra crib, those extra blankets. What a surprise. As I've been trying to say to you along as we have begun our study of the Gospel of Luke in the last few weeks, the Gospel of Luke is full of surprises. And really, Luke seems to take a great deal of delight in expressing surprise to us and telling us things that end up being very unexpected. Of course, it's really Jesus who does the surprising things. In just the last 3 weeks, we've looked at passages that reveal unexpected and surprising things. Jesus accepts a woman from a faraway place in Zidon, in an area called Zarephath. He accepts a general by the name of Naaman, a Syrian general that no Jew would expect a Jewish rabbi to accept. He rearranges the fish in the Sea of Galilee so that every one of them, it seems, jumps into Peter's nets. What a surprise. And he forgives the paralytic's sins when everyone is expecting him to heal the paralytic. Well, I think if you read the Gospel of Luke closely, as I would encourage you to do in these weeks and months, you really discover that it is in the surprises that the real message of God's truth and the message that Jesus has for us in the gospel comes out. It's revealed in the surprises. There we discover the power of the good news of the gospel. And so always when you're reading, in a sense, always when you're reading scripture, but especially I would suggest to you as we look at the Gospel of Luke, look for the unexpected. Look for the surprise. And there you may well find the deepest and best meaning that we can apply to our lives. Well, we see this here in this particular encounter which Jesus has with the Pharisees. From the point of view of Luke's Gentile readers, that is, the non-Jewish Greek people who were primarily those to whom Luke was writing, from their point of view, what would surprise them about the gospel of this itinerant Jewish rabbi? And I would propose to you in the passage that Bob read to us, there are at least two surprises that when we begin to understand them and apply them to our lives, they will surprise us too, very deeply and very profoundly. The first is that Jesus seeks the company of the sinner, not the religious person. And secondly, that Jesus prefers obedience to ritual. The first surprise. It is surprising to the Gentiles that a teacher of Israel would want to be with sinners, not the religious. They were used to rabbis. The Greeks were used to rabbis walking about who sought each other, who sought the religious crowd, who liked to be with religious people. But for a Jewish rabbi to seek the company of sinners, now that is a surprise. We accept it as a truism, really, today, looking back over 20 centuries, we accept it as a truism that Jesus appreciated the company of fishermen rather than fanatics, of prostitutes rather than the pious, of tax collectors rather than the religious traditionalists. But he was really quite radical in his time to do this. and I suspect really quite radical for our time too. There were two types of tax collectors in the first five books of the Old Testament in what's called the Talmud. First, there was the tax gatherer. He collected taxes for Herod, who would in turn turn them over to Caesar in Rome. You get an idea of how much the tax collector would be hated if you could imagine if you and I were required to pay taxes to the American Communist Party. And then those taxes were turned over to the government of Cuba in order to fund their military and domestic operations. That's really what was going on. The second kind of tax collector was the custom house officer. He had a kind of booth that was set up on a major highway, a well-traveled road, and he would extract taxes from the merchants who would travel that way. He would have to speak three languages in order to conduct his business. And Levi, who is called Matthew in the other Gospels, Matthew and Mark, Levi sets up his booth near Capernaum on a main road between the Mediterranean Sea and Damascus. And he would estimate the value of the goods that the merchants would bring through, and then he would tax them accordingly, but he would overtax them, and he would keep the overage. That's how he made his living. So you can imagine that these tax collectors were quite rich, and also quite hated. They were despised by the Jews. The Talmud calls them robbers. They were regarded as outcasts and traitors, much as we might regard American communists the same way. They were considered the lowest rung of the social ladder, and they were even hated by the people they worked for, the Romans. So they were hated by the Jews, they were hated by the Romans, they had no friends except who? Except people like them. According to the rabbis, there was no hope for a man like Levi, none whatsoever. He was excluded from all religious fellowship. His money would not be good or welcomed among Jewish merchants, and he was not permitted even to be a witness in a court of law. Well, when Levi follows Jesus, and he began to understand the power of the forgiveness that Jesus had given the paralytic and was now giving him, when he began to understand that the gospel was not just a nice story, but that the gospel was a living power that was going to change his life, when he began to understand that he, even he, a social outcast, could be accepted by the God of love who would change his life from within by the power of his own message, when he began to understand that, he invited his friends over to his house. Who were his friends? Well, we've already said it would be people like him, tax collectors and harlots, shepherds maybe, they were kind of low on the status rungs too, extortionists perhaps, and thieves. And then Levi included Jesus. In fact, he held the party in Jesus' honor. Levi wanted his friends to meet Jesus. And the Pharisees complain, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? To eat with a person was then, as it really is now, a sign of friendship. You eat with your friends, not your enemies. And Levi introduces Jesus to his friends. And Jesus happily goes along. He's doing what you might call a little gospel networking. In other words, Levi becomes his friend, and then Levi introduces Jesus to his friends, and on it goes. I actually know someone who had an experience very similar to this one that Jesus had being invited to Levi's home. This was a man who lived across the street from a very shadowy figure, a kind of mafia-like person. And strange things would happen in the middle of the night, and big, huge, long limousines would show up at weird hours of the morning. And this man lived across the street with his woman. And gradually, over time, my friend and his wife befriended this man and got to know him. They invited him into their house and had meals with him. Over time, they shared with him the power of the forgiveness of Jesus Christ and what Christ could mean in their own lives. Sometime after that, my friend was invited by his new friend to a party in his house. And he went. And the minute he walked in, he knew he wasn't with the religious crowd. The air was thick with smoke, with the smell of marijuana, with the smell of liquor. Everyone was having a rowdy good time. And my friend walked back to the kitchen where his friend was making the salad for dinner. And his friend sent him back to the living room and said, I want you to meet these people. Go in there and talk to them. So he went in and introduced himself and began to have a conversation. And then after dinner, his friend, my friend's friend, got everyone together and said, quiet, everybody. Shut up. Sit down. Be quiet over there. I want you to meet Ron. Ron, tell him. Ron goes, tell him what? Tell him about Jesus, Ron. Come on. Just like you told me about Jesus. And my friend Ron had the most wonderful opportunity to talk about the power of the forgiveness of Jesus Christ to people who he was dead sure had never heard that message before. You see, my friend, like Jesus, broke out of the accepted mold. He made friends, many friends, of sinners. The problem for us today is that many of us act as if the rules have changed for us. Some, not all of us, but some of us make a practice, a studied practice, of keeping our distance from the kinds of people that Jesus befriended. And in fact, we spend all of our discretionary time with people like ourselves. And out of a mistaken notion of purity or timidity or lack of time, or for some reason, we distance ourselves from the very people who need Jesus. And the very people that I dare say Jesus would seek out were he here. A couple of weeks ago, do you remember reading in the Dallas Morning News about the proliferation of these clubs and bars that exist all over the community, but especially, I guess, on that strip of Northwest Highway heading toward the airport? And do you remember that the estimate was that there were 1,700 young women who were involved working in those clubs? And I have heard conversations since, and even in the articles themselves, there was conversation about Christian people trying to shut those clubs down and so forth, and all that's very commendable. But I must say, if I could brag on my wife for just a minute, do you know what Barbara said? She said, what about those 1,700 girls? Who is reaching to them with the love of Christ? Who is going to them with the power of a message of forgiveness? Now, that's going to be Barbara's ministry. It's not going to be mine, I guarantee you. You know, over and against the Pharisees' idea of salvation through isolation, Jesus surprises us with a new principle. It's the principle of salvation through association. And Jesus says that all those who imagine themselves to be spiritually okay and who distance themselves from the spiritually needy, they are in fact in dire danger of missing, hear this now, dear friends, of missing the heart of the forgiving power of the gospel themselves. You see, the gospel is power. The gospel is the gospel of God's grace extended to who? To guys who wear robes? To people who look clean and sharp and have their hair combed and wear nice clothes? Well, yes, thanks be to God. Otherwise, a lot of us might not be here. But the gospel of the power of the forgiveness of Jesus Christ extends to the unlovely. And if we think otherwise or act otherwise, we may be in danger of reflecting that we ourselves have not grasped the power of that forgiving gospel in our own hearts. And instead, we live out of some kind of religious performance rather than the reality of our acceptance in the gospel of Christ's forgiveness. The religious establishment of Jesus' time avoided sinners. Jesus sought them out. And sometimes, despite the lip service we pay about reaching out to the lost, the religious establishment of our time often avoids sinners. Like the doctor who can only care for healthy people because he's afraid that if he's around sick people, he might get sick. I mean, it just makes no sense. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul is addressing a problem in the Corinthian church, and he refers to a letter that he had written them before that had apparently been misunderstood. He says, I have written to you in my previous letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. And then he goes on to say, but not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral, or the greedy, or the swindlers, or the idolaters. And then Paul says, in that case, you would have to leave the world. And dear friends, that's what many Christian people do today. We leave the world. And we act as though the sole thing that we have to do is pull together and pull among ourselves. And we lose our vision for extending the transforming power of the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ to the world around us. Surprise number one, Jesus seeks the company of sinners. One actually gets the feeling he enjoyed them. He liked being with them. Surprise number two, Jesus prefers obedience to ritual. Obedience to ritual. The religious folks are troubled not only with Jesus' friends, but with his disciples' irreverence. As it says in verse 33, they said to him, John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking. Jesus' disciples were just plain having too much fun. They were too cheerful, daggone it. Where's your morbid religious face? The Pharisees are saying. And did the practice of the mournful fast that the Pharisees and John the Baptist disciples carried on, they associated that practice with genuine religion. You remember John the Baptist had grown up in the desert. He had an austere lifestyle. He subsisted on locusts and wild honey. He had a skimpy diet, a strenuous schedule, and a very sober message. And the Pharisees also had a rigorous lifestyle. The Mosaic law called for them to fast only one day a year, that is on the Day of the Atonement. But they would often celebrate fasts on other days of the year, and then they became so committed to their fasting as a ritual by which they demonstrated their own religious nature that they decided it would be a good idea to fast on Monday and Thursday every week. So it's Thursday afternoon, and the Pharisees have on their mournful, no dinner tonight face. But Jesus and his disciples go to a wedding banquet. And the disciples of the Pharisees and of John the Baptist, they're a little bit jealous. While Jesus, of course, rejects ritualistic fasting for its own sake, he tells us in other places that fasting is a good thing. And it's clear that he himself fasted. The issue for Jesus was not whether or not you would fast, but it was when you would fast. The Jewish wedding was a particularly joyous occasion. The celebrations would often last for a week. And since fasting was associated with sorrow, it was unthinkable to fast during such a celebration. When the wedding banquet was over, Jesus implies, that's when fasting is proper. And Jesus was probably referring to the time when he, as the bridegroom, would be taken away and when he would be arrested with his disciples and made to suffer and crucified. Then is an appropriate time for fasting. Now we might say that because Jesus has come again in the person of the Holy Spirit, the bridegroom is here, and perhaps we find no need for fasting. But really, the kingdom is not complete. He's not fully here, and as we await his complete and full coming, it is appropriate for God's people to occasionally fast. But for the religious person of Jesus' time, his ritual of fasting became the way he controlled his religion. The ritual, you see, makes me the center of my religion, my performance, my religious duty, my doing good things. But the religion of Jesus does precisely the opposite. The religion of Jesus removes me from the center of the stage. The religion of Jesus puts Christ in the center and me as one who looks to him in faith and doesn't try and perform for him or for anyone else. Jesus, you see, prefers the unguarded, unprotected exposure of each person to himself. He does not want us to be safe in our religion. He rather wants us to be secure in his forgiveness. And there is a world of difference, isn't there?
You say, Skip, we're Protestants. We're not into ritual. Okay? Okay. Prove it. Prove it. How do you prove, as a Christian, you don't believe in ritual? By doing the opposite. What's the opposite of ritual? The opposite of ritual is spontaneous, joyful obedience. It's doing the thing which responds to the Lord in the moment. It's spontaneously saying, yes, Lord, I'll do it. Whatever you say, I'll do it. It's like one time when the lights are out. It's late at night. In fact, it's 12:30, 1 o'clock, and the phone rings. And it's your friend. And your friend is very sad because she has just admitted her mother to a local hospital. And you can tell your friend is very distressed. What do you do? You call Bob Nielsen and ask him to go visit, right? No. Maybe you get up out of your warm bed and you pull your sweater on over your pajamas and you go down to the hospital and you sit with your friend for a while. Maybe you do like a story I heard yesterday. Your son is out late. He's missed his curfew. You're starting to be worried and you call a friend and the friend immediately jumps up, gets in his car, and starts roving the streets where you and he suspect your son might be. The opposite of ritual is to promptly obey the impulse of word and spirit calling us to mercy. The danger, you see, is that if everything is under control, there's no risk in my spiritual life. And guess what? If there's no risk in my spiritual life, I don't need the Lord. I have everything under control. My religion is nice and neat. I fast on Monday. I pray on Tuesday. I go to church on Sunday. Isn't that sweet? No, it is not, at least not to the Lord. I need to be at risk. Because when I am at risk, I must exhibit faith. And according to the author of Hebrews, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Surprise number one, Jesus seeks the company of the sinner, not the religious. Surprise number two, Jesus prefers obedience to ritual. Now, by way of summarizing these surprises just very quickly, Jesus tells three pithy parables. He told them this parable: no one tears a patch from a new garment and sews it on an old one. If he does, he will have torn the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old. To tear a patch from a new shirt to repair an old shirt means you ruin both. It leaves a hole in the new shirt and it inadequately matches the old shirt. And the meaning of the parable is clear. You cannot take a part of Jesus' teaching and fit it into your old religious system. You cannot take Jesus without taking his commitment to sinners. You cannot take Jesus without taking his commitment to lost people. Did you hear me? You cannot have Jesus unless you have his zeal for those who are desperately in need of his forgiving message. And you cannot have Jesus without obeying spontaneously from the heart, in the moment, what he tells you to do. The religion of Jesus is not a pick-and-choose operation. The second parable makes the point even clearer. Verse 37, "And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, and the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined." In the first century, goat skins were used to hold wine. As the fresh grape juice would ferment, it would expand, and the new wine skins would expand with it. But if you tried to put the new wine into wine skins that had already done their expanding, when they expanded more, they would burst, and they would be ruined, and the wine would be lost. Gospel wine cannot be held and contained in the isolationist, ritualistic wineskins of the old Pharisees' religion. No, says Jesus in verse 38, new wine must be poured into new wineskins. The gospel wine must not be held in the protective custody of wineskins that can't really hold it, but rather in fluid and elastic wineskins that call us and allow us to reach out to our friends with the power of forgiveness. And the final little parable, verse 39, "And no one after drinking the old wine wants the new, for he says the old is better." Well, this little story is not about wine tasting. The comparative merits of old wine and new wine are really not the issue here. Rather, Jesus assumes that the aged, the wine that is more aged will be better appreciated than the wine that was bottled just last year. One who is accustomed to the old wine really won't want the new. Here's his point. One who is used to the familiar wine of isolation from sinners and the comfortable wine of ritual, that one may not want to try the new wine of friendship with sinners and moment-by-moment obedience. No, such a person would say, the old is better, the old is better. And there's the lie. There's the deception. We actually believe that the security of our man-made religious fortress is better than risking it and better than trusting the Lord in the land beyond the castle. Brothers and sisters in Christ, Jesus Christ did not come to build a castle. He came to build the church. And the church is a company of forgiven sinners who are seeking sinners like themselves. How surprised some of us are that Jesus Christ seeks the sinner. How surprised some of us are that Jesus prefers the wine of obedience to that of ritual. And behind these two surprises is the greatest surprise of all, that I am more like Levi and more like the Pharisees than I ever thought. And that the forgiving power of Jesus Christ seeks even me, seeks me in my sin, and seeks me in my pretending righteousness. And He loves me. He loves me. He forgives me. And He wants me to go to this world and extend the transforming presence of His kingdom to people who are a lot more like me than I dare to imagine. The surprising gospel of Jesus Christ. It isn't what some religious folks in the first century thought it was. And it isn't what some religious folks in the 20th century think it is. It's better. It's much, much better.